So tonight I like to look over a few things. So first I like to give just a few examples in terms of the phrases we were using today. So the first one was, I appreciate your efforts. And why I think it's important is for ourselves, but also especially for others. That often we think that they're not trying hard enough. And once I had this experience, I was supposed to help. It was a group of manager at a retreat center, and they had been having some difficulty with each other, and so I was called to try to have a meeting with them. And then what I decided to do was just to go around and ask each person to actually say what was their difficulty with themselves. And so everybody said, you know, what was difficult for themselves, what they were trying not to do, but they could not stop from doing. And so there was about 8 people. And what became clear to the group was that people did not do things because they were blind, that they were not aware they were doing it. But that, because everybody said, you know, what they found difficult. And of course, other people in the group found it difficult too. But actually to listen to everybody and to realize that, yeah, they're aware of what is problematic. They're trying to do something about it, but it's tough. And so each person had a different tough place. And after that, everybody was like, oh, they don't do it on purpose because of me. They're not blind to it. But it was more, oh, they're trying the best they can. And so out of that, not only arose appreciation, but actually compassion. And once they had compassion for each other, then actually it was much easier to deal with their difficulty. And that's when I really realized people generally try the best they can, but the result might not be there, but they do try. Then you have the next one, and this is rejoice in people's happiness, in people's success, in people's understanding. And it's interesting when people come on retreat, and so tomorrow you will all talk with each other, and I hope you share and you have a good time together. But sometimes you have, like, you know, what I would call the professional meditator, and they say, well, I had this insight. And then the other person, what? He had this insight, but I did not get it, you know? How come he had this insight? And we have to be careful of this, what I would call the competition. The competition. In whatever way it is. Recently I read about this fellow who was working in finance in New York. And he realized that actually at the beginning, I mean, before he had that job, he really did not earn that much money. Maybe he had like 20 or 30,000, $50,000 a year. And then suddenly he has his finance job. And then he gets his first bonus, yearly bonus. And for the yearly bonus, he gets $15,000. And he thinks, wow! This is amazing. So he's really rejoicing, really appreciating. But then he hears that somebody has actually got 100,000. And then his 15,000 was like, poof. And then he said it was a constant. What all the people in that job, they were actually, there was no enjoyment. The only enjoyment they could have was if they had a better bonus than the other. So it was not about enjoying the money and using it. It was actually about the competition. And that's why after a few years he stopped, because he said, I had all this money and I was so unhappy because other people had more. And once he stopped, he could go back to actually appreciate and rejoice. Another thing we do about this one is somebody might come with a good piece of news. Somebody comes and wow, this happened to me, it's fantastic, or this is going to, it's wonderful. And you, instead of saying, wow, that's great, wonderful, you say, but have you thought about this? And what about that? And this could happen, and this might happen. And then within 10 minutes, they're like, oh. And once I did this to a friend. She came with this wonderful piece of news, and I started to do, but what about this one? And then she said to me, but why are you doing this? Like deflating my happiness, questioning my happiness, forecasting terrible things. And I thought, why am I doing it? I mean, this was a good question. Why do we do this? Somebody comes with a good piece of news and then you kind of forecast all kind of terrible stuff. But I mean, right now, it has not happened. It might never happen. Why cannot we rejoice in that moment? And so that, I think, is very interesting to look at. Because this often happens with people who are very close to us. And it's like we are fearful on their behalf. I mean, do we need to be fearful on their behalf? I mean, if they say, I'm going to jump off the top of the cliff without anything, then yes, you can, you know, try to convince them it's not a good idea. But otherwise, so I think it's interesting that, what is it? And so can we make it a practice to actually rejoice with them? To me, this is a practice, to rejoice with them. And then the last one is gratitude. And I know in our modern society, and I would say a little kind of very marketing-orientated society, we kind of, you know, it's all give and take. You give me this, I give you that. So gratitude doesn't have much space to go in because it has to be equal. You give me this, I give you that, you know. But what was beautiful in Korea, as I said before, was that kind of like the gratitude that was, you could see in many different ways. And even in the text, they have like a text, but it's a Chinese text. It's not an original of the time of the Buddha text. Though you can find it in some other place in a different way. There is a text which has the 10 gratitudes. And a lot of the gratitudes is actually to your parents. So I know in the West, to your parents, woo! Well, you know. But what was beautiful for me was that my main teacher, Master Kuzan, he was a main Zen master of the temple I was in. And so he would sometimes be asked to give talks to lay people. And often, when he talked to lay people, he would talk about gratitude. And then he would talk about the different elements in that book. And every time he gave that talk, at number 8, he would cry. So, you know, here is his great Zen master, and he's talking to these people, and he said, and number 8, number 8. So I became curious about number 8, you know. And so finally, you know, I asked him, but what is this number 8? And he said, but number 8, is a gratitude you have for the suffering of your mother when you leave home for the first time. And every time I remember when I left home, when I was in my 20s, and I see my mother on the step and crying, and I go off. And I thought it was so sweet. Wonderful. So in a way, to see there are many different types of gratitude. And personal gratitude, family gratitude, social gratitude. I think there are many different ways that we can, in a way, recognize the value of people around us and their action and many other things. Then I also wanted to look a little, go back a little to the first talk, because in the first evening talk, I talked about that when we cultivate the concentration and the inquiry together, then we develop creative awareness. And as we develop this creative awareness, some of the quality of that creative awareness are wisdom and compassion. But with that creative awareness, I feel, comes actually two other more, you could say, immediate qualities, which are acceptance and transformation. And so, I think what we have to see, what is the advantage of being aware? But being aware in a caring and careful manner. This is very important. So as I said before, we're not trying to be aware in a judging way. This, I think, we have to be very careful not to use awareness, mindfulness, compassion in a judging way. I remember when we used to live in a community, Buddhist community in England, then people would accuse each other, "You are not mindful. You are not compassionate." And it was like, you know, there was a certain way, you know, you did not close the door properly, you were not mindful. You did not wash your cup, you were not mindful or compassionate. So in a way, they were using the terms to accuse each other. And I think we must be careful not to do this to ourselves. Like, you know, I am not mindful, this is terrible. I must be mindful all the time. You know, so that then it becomes this tense thing. When personally I see creative awareness as leading to this actually kind, clear acceptance. And the first time I had that experience was quite early on, as I was doing the meditation in Korea. And I was sitting in meditation, and suddenly I realized, suddenly I became aware of my thoughts. I mean, you know, I had thought up to that moment. But up to that moment, I had not been aware of what they were on about. And so I suddenly saw my thought and saw that they were all about me. I would say then 95% about, look at me, me, think of me. It was all about me. But up to that moment, I thought I was very compassionate, which meant I did not think of myself, but I thought of others. And it's true, if somebody would have asked me something generally, I would have tried to give it to them. But that was actually, I think, quite superficial. And when I was sitting there, I thought, wow, this is all about me. But then, I did not feel terrible. I did not think, I am the worst Buddhist in the world. I am the most terrible meditator. No, I thought, oh, that's what the problem is. You know, this intense focusing on me. That's what the difficulty. And actually, I thought it was funny. You know, I thought, oh, that's what you're doing. And then I noticed everybody else did the same. Because I was living with four other ladies in the room, and I noticed it was the same. They were thinking about themselves first. Definitely. So I thought, you know, all this meaning kind of going on in that room. And then, one day, it felt different. And it lasted for 2 weeks. And I thought, but what is going on? This is really different. It was feeling really nice and really, really special. And so I observed. And I realized that suddenly everybody together was doing things because of others. So they were thinking of others before thinking of themselves. And everybody was doing it together. And so it was really like paradise. It was wonderful. But like all things, it was impermanent. But what it showed me was that the creative awareness was a kind, accepting awareness. So the acceptance is not about being resigned. I don't like it, but I'm going to accept it. That's really not the idea. But the acceptance comes actually from seeing clearly. That's what the awareness is about, to really see clearly what's going on. And so then there is this acceptance in terms of that you really see and know what is really going on. And so part of the acceptance is actually accepting both our good quality and our difficult quality to the same degree. And so I think we have to be careful of always thinking, I must, you know, deal or do things with my negative habits. I think the creative awareness is as much about seeing the positive quality as the negative quality. And what is interesting, if you accept the positive quality, if you really feel, oh yeah, I can be wise, compassionate, stable, open, whatever, peaceful, then actually you know it's possible. I think it's very important to know, oh yeah, for at times I can be like this. And if you experience that, then you start to have great faith. Great faith in yourself, great faith in your potential. Instead of thinking, well, I might have a little bit of it, but not really, and really, you know, the great teacher has lots of it, but me, pff, no hope. I mean, nothing as much is going to happen. I remember when I was young, I was very bad at school in terms of the French, in terms of the composition. I was generally get very bad marks. So I would have never thought I would become a writer. That was not in the plan. But then I was in Korea translating and somebody said, oh, why don't you make a book of the translation of the teaching? And I thought, why not? And then somebody could help me with it, the English. And we did that. And then I went back to England and somebody came and said, oh, I see you wrote a book. I need to write a book about Buddhism and ecology. Can we write it together? And I thought, why not? Let's try. Instead of immediately thinking, I can't do it, I don't know how to write. I thought, why not? Let's try it. And then some other publisher wanted something. I thought, why not? Let's try it. But what was interesting was that in the accepting of it, in the accepting of the trying of it, actually the writing was really creative. The doing of it actually enables something else to come up. And that's why if we accept that we have compassion, wisdom, etc., then when there is a possibility of it, it is more actualized. It is more realizable. And then actually more can come out of it. That's what is interesting with this acceptance, is by knowing it, experiencing it, giving it some chance, then actually it can develop more. And I think that's why it's so important, that acceptance of our good quality. And also acceptance of what is difficult. Because sometimes we try, no, I don't want to see this, but in a way, in order to deal with our difficulties, we need to know them. We also, of course, need to know they're not always there. So that's what is interesting. One moment I am fine, next moment I am not fine. What happened? So I am not always angry or sad or fearful or whatever. So what happened? And so then that, I think, is part of the creative awareness, is to explore all this, the conditions, the contributing factors, the triggers, and then we can start to creatively engage with our difficult habits. So in a way, we have to know them. In a way, we have to experience them. We don't need to do it on purpose. We don't need to become angry on purpose. But when it happens, how does it feel? What happened? And so I think that's why the acceptance also of what is difficult, it's very important, because the acceptance is in a way what's going to help us to transform. And then what is interesting is that you have two types of transformation. You have what I would call the transformation that comes from acceptance. And that's interesting when, by just accepting something, actually you transform it. I had a friend who was very unhappy with her job. She always complained about job. Every year I would see her and she would complain about job. And so after a while she decided to, she would train in some other job and then things would be good. So after 3 years she finished the training, so I came, I said, oh, have you changed job? She said, no. Now I'm happy in my first one. So I said, what happened? And she said, one day, I decided to go and see, because she was also a meditator, to go and see, can I look at this differently? Can I look at the situation, at the people? Can I look at it differently? So she went with this kind of very newer look. And certainly she found a good way to be with it. And I found that fascinating, that for so many years she had difficulty with it, and suddenly she could change the way she looked at it. And so sometimes the transformation is through the acceptance. So you could say it's more like inner transformation that happened through the acceptance. But all the time, we need to have the transformation of the circumstances. So I think we have to be careful to think, just by thinking about something, just by meditating about something, that will be enough to transform. Not necessarily. Because you might be in difficult conditions. You might be, who knows, in the wrong place geographically or in the job or whatever it might be. And so sometimes you do have to look and see, would it be good to change my outer condition? So I think the transformation is kind of like both with the acceptance and the transformation, it can be both ways, inner or outer. And not just consider it's all inside. But sometimes you also have to look outside. So kind of exploring that. Then I wanted to look a little back to the listening. And listening, I think, is very important in many different ways. But one way is about conversation. So tomorrow you will be, the silence will be broken at breakfast, and you will be able to talk with each other. So you'll talk, you will listen. And then the question is, how do we listen? Because this is, I think, a great practice in daily life. And so generally I would say we listen in three different ways. First one, we listen and we wait for the person to stop so we can say something so much more interesting. So then we do actually three things. We listen one third, we wait one third, and we try to remember what we're going to say, which is so much more interesting, one third. So I would not say we're really listening. Second one, Second one, we look in the right direction. They say something, and we think of something totally different. So we think of the shopping list, or we think of the holiday, or we think of yesterday. And then they stop and they say, what do you think? And you have no idea what they said. But this is interesting. You know, your ears work, but it shows that if you're not aware, actually you don't hear. It's not that you don't hear, you don't perceive. Then the third one, you listen, but then you grasp at what they say and you amplify, which often is not very helpful. And to me, this is creative, meditative listening, to just listen. When the person speaks, you just listen, without preparing, without nothing, just listen. Very totally present. This is practice, totally present to the person. And when they stop, generally you will say something which is much more creative and appropriate, and often you will surprise yourself. How come? I did not know I could say this or I could. And why are we so creative? Because we're totally present to the thing itself. And so all our creative potential can respond just anew to that situation in that moment. And so this is something I would really encourage you to cultivate in daily life. Then listening also, I would connect to compassion. So compassion is something which is considered very important in Buddhism, in Buddhist meditation. And so the idea of compassion, and we generally are very keen on compassion, but I think it's interesting to explore what does it mean to be compassionate? And when are we compassionate? And are we compassionate because we feel compassionate? Because compassion is generally response to suffering. Somebody is suffering, generally we feel compassionate to that. But I think, in a way, compassion is more than feeling compassionate in response to suffering. And I think it's also, as a French philosopher, Gabriel Marcel, pointed out, it's also about being available. So that you're actually available to the other. You're available to the suffering of others, even if you don't experience a feeling. And his example is, you have somebody who is suffering, and you see them, and you say, yes, 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 you're suffering, you're in pain, I want to be compassionate. And you say to them, you know, in 2 days, I will go and see you in the hospital. But in the 2 days, meanwhile, lots of things happen. And then when you have to go, you don't have the same feeling because the person is not there. You just have the appointment. But you still go because you're available to the person. You're available to their suffering. So I think this is something I think is important to consider. And also in terms of compassion, to look at compassion in terms of being equal. That often there is I think it's very important to say that there is equality in humanity. So that actually, when we are compassionate, I think personally it's a practice, because it opens us to the other. To be open to suffering, help us to come out of this self-centeredness. And then it helps us to open to the other. So I would nearly say, we need to be grateful. Not for the person suffering, but for actually them being there and us being able to open to them. So a compassionate movement is to open to someone else, which I think is a practice. But then, so you have the feeling, you have the availability, you feel this equality, this connection. But the compassion is not just a feeling. I think it's a creative, wise action. It's a creative, wise response. And then that's where the listening comes in. Because there is suffering, and we want to respond to that suffering, but how do we respond? Because there are two questions there in the response. What is it they need, and can I give it? To me, this is a two fundamental question. Because often we can have what I call ideological compassion, kind of theoretical compassion. I know what's best for you. Maybe not. Or I am going to help you because once I had this, I had a friend who had lots of difficulty, and I asked her, what can I do to help? And she said, if you could visit my mother who is in a nursing home, that would be good, once a week. And so I thought, great, her mother is old, we can talk about death, we can talk about impermanence, we can talk about conditionality, that should be fun, very interesting. So off I go to meet her mother for the first time. And I go there, and that day she had lots of hallucination. And when she hallucinated, she saw insects. So she would suddenly look, and like she looked like she saw, like, you know, giant spider or giant fly or something which was really frightening. And then my job actually was to distract her, not to talk about impermanence or anything. But what I learned to do was to distract her from the hallucination. So when I would see her going a little funny, I would say, oh, what about the cricket match? What about making jam? And in a way, I had to learn what she liked so I could distract her with it. And so it was very different than my idea of how I was going to be compassionate. Because what I had to do is listen. What is it she needs? How can I help her here and now? Not in my idea, but in the experience of it. But then there is another aspect, which is, can I give what they need? Because sometimes people might ask you for something. I am suffering, please help me. But can you give it? And so I think we have to see that when with compassion, there is a range. On one side you have other people, on this side you have yourself, and then you have in the middle. And so sometimes we can be for others. Sometimes we can be for others and for ourselves. And sometimes we just can be for ourselves. So I think we have to see that compassion is as much for self as for others. And through that we can know our limitation. What are our limitations in terms of compassion? When I was, because I was so special in Korea, I would often appear in magazines, because I was special, so the journalists would come, take picture of this foreign nun, French nun, and then I would appear in various magazines or newspaper or something like that. And then I could guarantee that if I appeared in a newspaper, within a week, I would get a few letters, and all from young Korean people asking me for money. Because I was European, I must have money. Because this was in the 70s. Now it's very different. In the 70s, they were very poor. And I was a nun, and I had very little money. So I used to think, how can I get money? And I used to, what about my parents? And I would come to the, I don't have money. So then I would send them a letter saying, I'm sorry. I mean, I would give them, you know, like 5 euros if I had it. I said, I'm sorry, that's all I have. So I could see that however much I wanted to help them, I did not have what they needed. So we have to see sometimes how much we want to help, we don't have what is needed. But sometimes we don't have in terms of energy. Sometimes we don't have in terms of time. So I think we have to see what is it we can do? What are our limitations? And in a way, accept also those limitations. Of course, sometimes we can have what I call heroic compassion, where you really can totally give yourself to the other. But generally that cannot last, because this is a little going beyond your limits, and generally you cannot sustain it. I mean, I remember once a friend phoned me, and I could really hear that she really, really was unwell. So straight away, I had other things planned, but straight away I went. And I stayed actually all day with her. And every hour I would check inside myself, can I go? No, not yet. And then the day passed, and then toward 5 I thought, she seems okay now. And then I went back home. But I could not, I've done this all the time. But that one time, I could do it. And I could find other way to do the other thing later. So sometimes we can have this heroic compassion, but not all the time. I think we have to be very careful with that, because we have limits of time, but also limits of energy. Then there is what I would call compassion because you feel bad. And then we have to be very careful of that one. That's why I think we'd be very important to look at creative wise compassion. You know, sometimes we give something to somebody, but actually it's not very compassionate. I remember my sister used to grow a lot of big pumpkin, and she always wanted to give me some. And I thought, and I really did not know what to do with it. Oh, I remember long ago when I was in Korea, early days. In Korea, if you eat, you cannot eat on your own. You have to share it with somebody. If you don't share it, you cannot eat it. It's the way it is there. So I was very hungry at the bus stop, and I want to eat nuts. But I felt I could not eat them on my own. So then I look for a likely victim of my compassion, of my sharing. And I found a very sweet little boy. And so I offered him some nuts, and the mother could not refuse. I was a nun. And then within 2 minutes, he had everywhere. It was a disaster. And that's what I learned. That really was not compassion. It was kind of, using the other person to be compassionate. Maybe we have to be a little careful with that one. Another one we have to be careful with is what I would call barter compassion. I am compassionate but hoping to get something back. And often when we're compassionate, the first thing we wait for is that somebody say thank you. My mother used to be very compassionate. But one thing she really needed was that people say thank you. And so sometimes the niece, the nephew, they did not say thank you. She said, well, they did not say thank you. And I said, well, you gave it. Just let it go. And my teacher, Master Cousin, had a wonderful image for that. He said, when you give something with compassion, you should think that you are giving a dirty mop. In Finnish, dirty mop. And so if you gave a dirty mop to somebody, you would not say, wow, now you say thank you. I was really good to you. You just say thank you to him or her for taking it. And that's what I think we have to see, that in a way this compassionate movement is a creative response. And in a way it has to be a creative response which is not expecting anything. I think this is very much part of it. So you give something and that's it. It's kind of given. And finally, the last thing about compassion that we have to be aware of is that when we are compassionate, it means that we are touching suffering. And that if we touch suffering, it's going to be sad. We're going to be sad. I think this is, that's why I think compassion actually is very difficult in some way. Because it makes us touch suffering again and again. And generally that makes us sad. And so we have to, that's why we need equanimity. So that we're not overwhelmed by the sadness. But we can, in a way, I would say, endure the sadness. So I'll just finish with this story that we often, with my husband, I teach together with him often, and we time to time go to teach in South Africa and in a center which is close to lots of Zulu tribal villages where generally they are quite poor. And so over the time we went there, we tried to help out in different ways. And so one time the people told us, come and see these people in this hut. The understanding was that if we saw them, we would do something for them. So we thought, why not? Let's go. So we go to this hut, and it was so sad, because it was so destitute. It was a broken pot, and a poor lady, and a poor, it was really, really destitute. And so I was sitting there, and I felt so sad. Of course, I could help that family, and we did help it, and they became much happier through that help. But what made me sad was to know that we could help this family, but we could not help all the other family who were just like them, without any resources, without any support. And so that's where the sadness came. The compassion, the action was to help them, which was what it was for them. But the sadness often comes from that realization that they are in these very difficult circumstances, but they're not the only one in those difficult circumstances. And so after that, for 2 weeks, I did feel sad. But the sadness did not stop me from teaching, from interacting. But I was very aware of that sadness. And so I think, in a way, to be aware of that, that when we try to be compassionate, we try to be with suffering, we also need, in a way, to cultivate equanimity so we can bear the suffering. We can bear the compassion.